Hi, I'm Carla Nappi, and this is New Books in Science, Technology, and Society. Thanks so much for joining us. I just spoke with Joel Isaac about his new book, Working Knowledge, Making the Human Sciences from Parsons to Kuhn, that was published with Harvard University Press in 2012. Now, this is a contribution to the history of science, but also to the history of social thought, the history of philosophy, and many other fields besides. What Isaac is doing in this book is offering a corrective to the way the history of thought to intellectual history, the history of philosophy and the social sciences is often written. And that is with an approach that focuses on the development of ideas and the development of isms, rather than the development of attitudes toward practice. What Isaac shows in this book is the centrality of practices, craft, pedagogy, and so on and so forth, in the development of some of the, what we consider to be the major ideas in the history of the human sciences, and in the development further of the human sciences in particular as a field and as a set of engagements and inquiries. So it's a major methodological contribution to a number of fields in that respect. Isaac does this by focusing on the context of Harvard University in the 20th century and showing the presence of what he calls an interstitial academy. This is so interstitial in the sense of the space between grains of sand, right? The margins, the spaces in between. What this is essentially a way to describe the kinds of intellectual and social spaces that exist outside of the confines of official departments. So in discussion groups, in informal seminars, in places like the Society of Fellows, and so on and so forth. And he's showing how these contexts actually allowed the emergence of dominant discourses of the human sciences in many ways. The story culminates in what is, I think, an extraordinarily fresh reading of one of the classics of the history of science and of social thought in general, and that is Thomas Kuhn's Structure of Scientific Revolutions. Along the way, there are very detailed and very carefully argued case studies that look at different contexts within this interstitial academy at Harvard that developed some of the major ideas and major figures that we think about when we think about the history of human sciences in America. So it's very well written. It's very carefully argued. There are moments in the book that didn't actually come up in our conversation that are actually also quite funny. So I direct your attention, listeners, if you can find it, to the case here where William James is talking about the device for whirling frogs in his office. And so there are little points like that that are also just really funny and really fun. So it was a great conversation. I really learned a lot from the book and from talking with Joel about it, and I hope you enjoy. We're here today at New Books in Science, Technology, and Society to talk with Joel Isaac about his new book, Working Knowledge, Making the Human Sciences from Parsons to Kuhn. Welcome, Joel, and thank you so much for making the time to talk with me today.
Thank you for inviting me.
My pleasure. So, Joel, could you start us off by saying a little bit about yourself and your background? What brought you to this field that we might describe as modern American intellectual history in the first place?
Sure. I don't know how interesting a story this will be, but it's certainly important to me. So I was trained as an Americanist. I studied a lot of American history as an undergraduate. And then I came to Cambridge, where I did my graduate work and got my PhD with an interest in American history. And something that the history faculty in Cambridge was known for, and is known for actually, is the study of intellectual history, and in particular the history of social and political thought. And I guess pretty early on in my graduate work, I wanted to find a way of combining an interest, a broad gauge interest in American history with the study of social and political thought. And so I I kind of played around with ideas for a while on this score and was looking for a sort of way in. And I have to admit, actually, that the thing that really drew me into studying the history of the social sciences, something of an embarrassing confession in some ways, but was, well, I read, the book itself is actually very good. It was later made into a film, but I read a book, a biography of the economist and game theorist John Nash Jr. called A Beautiful Mind. This was later made into a rather terrible movie starring Russell Crowe, which is the embarrassing part. But I read this book on the history of game theory and this very interesting conception of human rationality. And I became more and more interested in, I guess, formal approaches to the study of rationality and the role that could play in the formation of economic and social policy. And that drew me bit by bit into, in fact, some of the figures that I discuss in the book, particularly Tucker Parsons, and the project, the book kind of emerged from those initial interests, I'd say.
Right. Now, the book at hand, the book that we're talking about now, it shows ultimately how Thomas Kuhn's arguments in the structure of scientific revolutions emerged from a conversation, and as you show here, a long-forgotten conversation about the sources of knowledge and the validity of knowledge in the human sciences. But it's not just a story about Kuhn. Rather, it's a story that takes us through the emergence of the human sciences in the 20th century U.S. And so it manages, on the one hand, to be this very deep but very carefully argued history of the human sciences. And in the process, you're also managing to take a classic text in science studies, I mean, a text that everybody who studies the history of science or science studies in some ways has to read, and amazingly, you're making it new and you're making it fresh, which is really, really impressive and just quite surprising as a reader who's really familiar with the structure of scientific revolutions to come to this and come away feeling like, I understand it in a completely different way. So it's a great book. It's a great project. How did you come to this topic in particular? What brought you to this field?
Sure. Firstly, thank you for those kind remarks. And in fact, you know, it's I'm glad that you mentioned the things I have to say about Kuhn. I mean, he appears in the last chapter, but I feel like actually this rereading of the structure of scientific revolutions really is, certainly for me, the kind of payoff of the history that the kind of deeper history that I give in the book of the development of the human sciences in the United States. But in terms of the project, I mean, So I mentioned a moment ago that I became interested in formal conceptions of rationality, some of them connected with decision theory, others with kind of structural functionalist sociology. I was interested in this kind of topic and interested in how these ideas had emerged in the 20th century United States. And so I went for my sort of first substantial research trip to Harvard to work on, as is the wont of an historian, to work on the unpublished papers of Talcott Parsons, this kind of towering figure in mid-20th century American sociology and social thought. And I began working on these papers of Parsons. And I discovered really this fascinating local tradition of thinking about the epistemological foundations of the human sciences. I was interested in finding in Parsons's work and in his interaction with his colleagues at Harvard, a longer tradition of thinking about the foundations of knowledge in the human sciences. And what I began to do was partly, or in large part through archives, as well as through published work, to reconstruct this tradition of thinking about the foundations of knowledge in the human sciences or the social sciences. And I began filling out that network, and a lot of the book really is me filling out that network. But slowly, and this actually was for me quite a slow realization, I realized that the structure of scientific revolutions was, in many respects, a distillation and also the terminal point of this tradition of the human or social sciences at Harvard. And it took a while for that idea to kind of click. I'd always read structure kind of separately. I was interested in the book, but only kind of bit by bit, particularly by looking at Kuhn's footnotes, did I realize that, that kind of Kuhn was a part of this story. So this is really, in a way, a long-winded way of saying I started off focusing on this single figure, Parsons, and then really through serendipity, I discovered this local tradition or series of local debates about the foundations of knowledge in the human sciences that had, I think, a broader significance. And so I spent a good bit of time trying to develop that story and figure out who the important characters were. But it all really emerged from the happenstance of working in the Parsons papers in the Harvard University archives and discovering this, what I like to think is a kind of previously obscured network and a previously obscured tradition of thinking about knowledge in the human sciences. So I hope that's an answer to your question.
Absolutely. Now, this book actually originally began as a dissertation. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. So can you talk a little bit about that transition from dissertation to book? Were there any major challenges? Were there any major transformations? What was that process like for you?
Yeah, there were some very important challenges and transformations in the project. In the dissertation, I didn't yet have a fully worked out sense of what I was, in response to your previous question, describing as this local kind of Harvard tradition of thinking about the foundations of knowledge. And in fact, the dissertation was less the study of a coherent tradition or even a kind of institutional history. It was a comparative history of three different figures, one of whom dropped out of the book project altogether. And that person is the economist, Kenneth Arrow. So I wrote a dissertation on, it was a somewhat broader study of debates about the scientific status of the social sciences and of philosophy in the middle decades of the 20th century in the United States. And my central figures were Tucker Parsons, the sociologist, Willard Van Orman Quine, the American philosopher and logician, and Kenneth Arrow, a very famed economist who's contributed to multiple fields of economics, but was most famous in his early career for work on welfare economics and democratic theory. And so I'd written this comparative study for the dissertation, and I was sort of, I realized it wouldn't work as a book quite early on, not least because the kind of comparative element, while important and I hope sort of illuminating in certain respects, I don't think it fully cohered, and I felt like the book would need a much clearer narrative, and that the PhD thesis was too episodic. And I also realized that this economist wasn't going to fit in the story that I had to tell. And so, to be honest, after finishing the PhD, I was kind of stuck in a way, or at least there seemed to me multiple ways of proceeding with the project, maybe adding more figures for comparison, and as it were, kind of dialing up the episodic quality, and just offering something like a survey, or trying to find a way of telling a much more coherent historical story or a story of historical development. And I wanted to take the second approach. And it took me a while to realize that Harvard University in the 20th century was going to be really the kind of fulcrum of the study, that this would give me an institutional context from which to extract this kind of broader story about debates regarding the foundations of knowledge in the human sciences. I'd recognized Quine, who was this other figure of comparison in the thesis, had also been at Harvard, was there for his whole career, and in fact taught Tucker Parsons' son Charles Parsons, who is an extremely distinguished philosopher of mathematics. And that, just thinking about these kind of networks, got me approaching more carefully the idea that there was this kind of coherent network at Harvard. And basically, I finished the thesis, and I had a postdoc, a research-based postdoc, here in the UK at Cambridge, actually. And I decided to not scrap the thesis, but to sort of start again and to draw up a project kind of from the ground up, but focusing on some of the same questions that I'd been interested in the thesis. And so I spent a good bit of time in the US, off and on for about a year or so, working in the archives at Harvard and elsewhere, and drawing out the story of this network and thinking about its implications. And so what that meant, to be honest, in the longer term, was I realized that I wasn't going to be able to move rapidly from the thesis to the book. And I sort of realized that I'd have some time, partly thanks to the postdoc and partly for other reasons to do with the, frankly, the pathologies of the administration of higher education in the UK. I would have time to write a book and not have the pressure of what's here called the research assessment exercise to have a book out quickly. And so so I started again. I did more a lot more archival research, and it turned out that the only what remains of a thesis in the book really is, I have a chapter, which we may talk about later, on the philosopher Quine. Mm-hmm. That's the one part of the thesis that remains, and everything else was kind of thought up more or less from scratch, after deciding that I needed a more coherent project for the book, frankly. So that was kind of challenging, rewarding, anxiety producing at certain moments. I went from a postdoc to a job, and as of course everyone in academia knows, you lose a lot of research time when you're teaching things for the first time and so forth. And so it took me another 6 or 7 years to finish the book. That's a way of describing the what for me at least felt like an odyssey from the thesis to the book.
That's great. Thank you so much for sharing that. And I think you're bringing up a few things that are really important and really interesting. And I'll just sort of mention one of them, which is increasingly the importance of the postdoc, right? After we finish, I mean, I was very grateful to enjoy one of those as well. I think it's so important for giving us the space to be able to step away from the crush and the burnout of the doctoral process and the dissertation. And clearly in this case, that and the extra time and the extra work that you put into refashioning the project really paid off, because at the end of the day, this very much reads like a very careful and a very coherent argument that stretches throughout the whole book and that ultimately results in, as I mentioned before, a very surprising conclusion that manages to take. I mean, it's the equivalent of, for a historian of science, right? This may be somewhat hyperbolic, but I don't think it's too hyperbolic. It's the equivalent of sort of managing to say something new about Shakespeare, right? It's like, wow, I thought I knew this book, this is making me see it in a new way. So thank you for sharing that.
Sure.
It clearly paid off. So the book itself, as we get into the chapters, what it does, as I mentioned, is it situates Kuhn within this larger context of 20th century philosophers and social sciences who were collectively part of this transformation, where this culture of inquiry that they were part of was attempting to connect, and successfully, I think you show at the end, connected both a philosophy of epistemology and also a concern with the practices of the sciences. The thread binding these together, as you show early on in the book, is something that you call scientific philosophy. Now, Very early on in the book, there's a suggestion, and it's a very strong suggestion, and it's one you come back to at the end of the book, that we move beyond explanations of history of the sciences, history of social sciences, that rest on largely ideological battles between isms or over-isms, positivism, naturalism, historicism, etc., or over these large-scale issues of rationality and objectivity. You focus here, and you're very explicit about focusing your analysis on practice, not ideology. And ultimately, when we come to the end of the book, we'll see that a focus on and a very careful attention to practice was also what winds up generating Kuhn's ideas and structure and many of the ideas that we see along the way. So I wonder if you could start us off by talking a little bit about that, this effort to help us move away from a focus on argument based on ideology and isms and toward arguments that put practice at the center stage.
Of the book, really, it's how I frame the book was and is extremely important to me. So I mentioned earlier that I knew I wanted to write about the history of social thought and history of sciences in the United States. But as I came to read the literature on the history of the social sciences, economics, sociology, psychology, and so on, I noticed that conceptions of knowledge, the conceptions of knowledge that fueled the development of these, the disciplines of the social sciences, tended to be read by historians in what I call in the book rather epic terms. So there seemed to me to be a sort of conflation of sort of epistemic commitments about the character of knowledge and empiricism and so on with more general views about with philosophical anthropology, views about human nature or human situation. And it seemed to me that telling or reading sort of debates about the theory of knowledge in these very grand ideological terms in terms of, scientism, positivism, the dominance of empiricism in the modern intellectual culture of the West and so on, that approach was leading historians, particularly of the 20th century human sciences, to miss these more practice-oriented local concerns that I think were also, and I tried to show in the book, were driving debates about knowledge and the developments of the human sciences in the 20th century. And as I say, I felt like a number of intellectual historians were neglecting practices by focusing on these ideological dimensions of knowledge. And it seemed to me that in doing this, the historians, and I don't mean to at all denigrate the very important contributions of earlier scholars, the previous generation of historians of the American social sciences, but just to say that it seemed to me philosophers who'd written in an historical vein, like Richard Rorty in Philosophy in the Mirror of Nature, Charles Taylor in a number of essays, in particular The Sources of the Self, the intellectual historians had followed the philosophers relating what seemed to me quite local developments, local debates, or at least developments in modern philosophy, modern sociology, and so on, that had local explanations, conflating those developments with epic developments in, as I say, this is Taylor's phrase, the intellectual culture of the West, or these kind of broad terms. And it seemed to me that, that was missing a lot of the historical context. And I know something I urge in the book is that intellectual historians ought not to be seduced by the epic histories of the human sciences offered by Foucault and Rorty and Taylor, as important and brilliant in many respects as those kind of philosophical histories are. And I sort of drew inspiration and encouragement for this kind of critique and this attempt to offer a more fine-grained analysis of the history of epistemology in the social sciences from historians of science. And so the practice term in the study of science inaugurated first, of course, in histories of experimental science, inaugurated by figures like Simon Chaffer, but more recently work on theoretical practices discussed by, you know, obviously David Kaiser, Peter Gallison, and others, that this was a literature that would be of importance for intellectual historians, and it was of major importance for me in attempting to write this book. And it seemed to me that the focus on practice and on institutions, pedagogy, research practices and so on, would be an important antidote to these epic histories. And I should just add to that general sort of point there, this view of the problems of what can be lost with epic histories of knowledge is a point that was driven home for me by Joseph Rouse in his book Engaging Science. I mean, he makes exactly that point, really. And so I felt like historians of the social sciences and intellectual historians of the United States certainly, in my own case, could learn a lot from the study of experimental and theoretical practices in the history of science. And so a big part of how I frame the book and how I see the book contributing to the fields that I know is by appealing to that methodological approach honed in history of science and in science studies.
Thank you so much. Now, as we move into the book, you've mentioned already specifically that your research focused on Harvard, and in fact, the argument of the book is also very much localized to what's happening at Harvard. At the beginning of the book, in the first chapter, you invoke what you call the Harvard complex in describing the importance of Harvard to this history and to the story that you're going to tell. Can you talk about that notion to get us started along this route? What is the Harvard complex, and why and in what way is that central to the story that you're telling?
Sure. So the Harvard complex is really a rubric that I invoke to pick out a quite unusual institutional structure, or perhaps to put that slightly more clearly, to pick out a set of, they might be departments, they might be reading groups, they might be research laboratories in some cases, but a particular cluster of institutional forms that existed either kind of on the margins of Harvard's sort of organizational chart during the middle decades of the 20th century, or in fact were themselves very inchoate departments or graduate schools. I mean, the Harvard Business School is another example for me of one institution that belongs to this Harvard complex. But all of these, what I want to say is that they existed either between established departments or between levels of the university, from the college to the graduate school, or they were reading groups of some sort or another, or kind of, you know, faculty seminars that couldn't comfortably be slotted into the main run of university departments or into Harvard College and so on. Now, this idea of the Harvard complex is important because, as I argue in the book, it's within these marginal, I also call them kind of interstitial fora, that the human sciences at Harvard, the philosophy and the social sciences develop and are ultimately institutionalized in the context of Harvard University. And so that's really a central part of the story. And again, it's something that just became clear to me as I was working on tracing out this network of thinkers in philosophy and the social sciences who were at work at Harvard during the middle decades of the 20th century, that a lot of them were involved in institutional innovation, or they were pushed against their will to the margins of the university and had to fight to establish disciplines like sociology, for example. And so I wanted, you know, a rubric or a kind of term to hang that idea on, and the Harvard complex, and also this idea I bring up a little bit later in the book of the Interstitial Academy, is my way of trying to offer a general category for those different kinds of institutional forms, which are a central part of my story in the book.
Great. And this idea of the Interstitial Academy winds up being absolutely central to not just what's happening early in the book, but plays a role in each one of the chapters afterwards, in which you show in different ways and using different, in most cases, different sets of figures and different case studies, the ways in which this Interstitial Academy really created opportunities for the emergence of particular ways of focusing on practice, and in particular scientific practice, that ultimately leads to the configuration of the human sciences that winds up by the epilogue turning into things like Institutes for Advanced Study and the National Humanities Center, which I'm at right now. So thank you, National Humanities Center. So this winds up becoming a really powerful idea that helps us think through not just what happens at Harvard, but also this winds up being a kind of introduction to an early history of interdisciplinarity in the American Academy.
Yeah.
So as we move into these cases or into these sort of local studies of the emergence of these ways of thinking, given this Interstitial Academy at Harvard, we move into some key players that form the backbone of this study and ultimately lead us to the end and the emergence of the structure of scientific revolutions. Chapter 2 focuses on the Harvard group devoted to the sociology of Vilfredo Pareto. So because Pareto's work, again, is not just important here, but becomes important in putting together the pieces later on, can you sort of briefly explain the nature of Pareto's work in 1916 and what made that so important for the group at Harvard that was working with it and ultimately taking up Pareto's ideas?
Sure. I should preface this by saying I treat Pareto's thought in the book somewhat at arm's length, as it were. I treat his thought through the work of the Pareto Circle. So I wouldn't call myself a Pareto scholar, but of course it is important to think about why, in particular, Pareto's treatise of general sociology become important to a major figure, the leader of the Pareto Circle, L.J. Henderson, is someone for whom Pareto is extremely important. But Pareto's work is also discussed by, in fact, the young Talcott Parsons and many other figures, including George Homans and a number of pioneering American social scientists in the 1930s and 1940s. And so, as many of your listeners will know, Pareto comes to sociology in part because of his frustration with the limits to the instrumental rationality that is described and is the premise of his work in economics, and in particular in his work on general equilibrium in economics. Pareto feels himself needing, in addition to his account of instrumental rationality, an account of what the translated Pareto calls non-logical behavior, and the Trattato, Pareto's long work on sociology, is an attempt to give an account of the role of non-logical behavior in social life and in the formation of social order. And so Pareto is interested in dissecting the variables that together constitute the non-logical aspects of human behavior. And he has this kind of technical jargon of residues and derivations. But in a way, I mean, it's one can see Pareto as continuing a discourse about the role of the passions instituted in, I suppose, Renaissance moral philosophy, and continuing through into the Enlightenment and the work of Hume and others. And Henderson, who is one of the great expositors of Pareto, as I mentioned a moment ago, is himself very interested in drawing on sources in early modern political thought to kind of fill out Pareto's theory of the non-logical roots of social action. And so there's an account of these fundamental instinctive sort of drives and passions that are central to human behavior. The way that Henderson reads Pareto is also that there's a kind of element of, although Henderson would have hate this kind of idea, there was an element of a reception of Freudian theory in the idea that agents in acting will try to portray their actions as rational, but these are in fact nothing more than post hoc rationalizations, or what Pareto calls derivations. And that's another, these derivations or rationalizations of fundamentally irrational behavior is another important part of Pareto's social theory, as that is received and articulated by, in particular, Henderson, but also other members of the Pareto circle. And just a sort of footnote to that set of pretty generic comments about Pareto's social thought. It's interesting that Pareto's path to sociology, marked as it is by a deep engagement with essentially what we think of now as microeconomics and accounts of economic rationality, that path of Pareto's is in fact replicated by the reception of Pareto in the United States. And again, among thinkers like, in particular, Tucker Parsons, there is a recognition that formal or orthodox economics, the kind of economics practiced by the Austrian school of marginalists like Karl Menger, this very formal account of rationality must be supplemented by a broader account of the role of values and various instinctual, perhaps even irrational, forces in the making of social order, precisely because it's become clear that the world doesn't work in the way that the classical economists and then later the marginalists think that the world does. And so individual rationality must have a broader social basis. And it was believed that thinkers like Pareto had answers to what that broader basis might be. And so that's just a way of kind of sketching in the intellectual background of the Pareto circle in the reception of Pareto in the United States.
Great. Thank you so much. Now, in the book, you're showing that this is actually linked in the development of the Pareto Circle is linked with discipline building within this interstitial academy at Harvard that you're showing. Now, you've mentioned already the Harvard biochemist Henderson, who led this circle and who was responsible for kind of galvanizing interest in Pareto and creating this network around Pareto's work. An important development here, and in the context of Henderson, and also something that happens early on here that we see having pretty profound ramifications throughout the later chapters of this story, is the development of a case method as a pedagogical tool at Harvard. And this effectively brings in not only the specificity of the method of the case, which is going to continue to be important, but also the importance of pedagogy as a very explicit form of the way these social thinkers were working through ideas and were working through the work of people like Pareto. So can you talk a little bit about the case study, or the case method, rather, as it's developed, and the importance of this for what's happening at Harvard?
Sure. Finding this, there is at Harvard from the 19th century, the the last third of the 19th century through to the present, really, a long tradition of the use of the case method across fields. I mean, it begins its life principally in the law school of Christopher Columbus Langdell as a pedagogical tool. But interestingly, even for Langdell, the use of the case method to teach, in his own case, contract law, it wasn't just a pedagogical tool, right? It was also in itself for Langdell, a kind of epistemology, which is to say one understood the law as a kind of organic growth through the study of just the right set of cases. So the case method begins with Langdell. The method is taken up directly from the law school into the medical school by a figure called Walter Cannon, who is interested in modes of pedagogy as they use in the law school, and thinks that this will revolutionize the teaching of medicine. Goes into medicine. Henderson is himself exposed to the case method in the medical school. And from there, Henderson takes it to the business school, back into the college. He passes the idea on to James Bryant Conant, who uses it as the basis for his famous course Natural Sciences 4 on the history of the experimental sciences, and then eventually, as I argue in the book, it goes on to Kuhn and informs, if doesn't entirely account for, Kuhn's notion of the paradigm. So that's really just a preliminary comment to say that this case method is really it's a central feature of the Harvard story I want to tell, and it's one of the, and as you say, as you rightly say, it's a central strand running through the book as a whole. But what was interesting to me was something that I've touched on in discussing how Langdell saw the case method, which is that the case method, it wears many hats. So on the one hand, it is seen as a very convenient and effective mode of pedagogy rather than, you know, taking a very didactic approach to teaching, you know, recitation, reading out sections of textbooks and so on. One encourages students to think in a somewhat Socratic way by handling cases, and that gives them an appreciation for a body of doctrine that isn't to be gathered in any other way. It has this pedagogical function, but increasingly from Langdell onwards, really, it's also seen as a way of accessing, perhaps indeed a preeminent way of accessing knowledge of, in the case of the Pareto Circle, fundamental social laws. Henderson employs the case method in teaching what he calls concrete sociology, which is his kind of Pareto-inspired view of how to teach sociology as essentially a kind of applied or sort of clinical science. So it seems to, in this case, be also serving an epistemological role, or it's a form of inquiry as well as simply a form of pedagogy. And it became rapidly clear to me as I said, that the case method winds its way through several different facets of the development of the human sciences at Harvard. And that this is one way in which that local practice-oriented story I wanted to tell, that way in which debates about the conceptual foundations of a discipline get tied up with institutional questions of, the formation of curricula, the teaching of particular disciplines or subfields and topics, the way in which those practice-oriented questions ought to inform our history of the social sciences. So that was really key for me. And just a final remark on the importance of the case method here is that, so it's not just that the case method can wear sort of several hats. It's as I say at a certain point in the book. I mean, it's a kind of theory of knowledge. It's a gloss on research practice, and it's a form of pedagogy all at once. But given that this is a method, a form of pedagogy and of inquiry that has this long and established and well-respected lineage running from the law school to the medical school and onto the business school, it's seen as central to a kind of professionalization Those advocates of the social sciences at Harvard, particularly the new social sciences of anthropology, sociology, social psychology, those people who are looking to establish their disciplines in an institution which is very hostile for certain reasons to these new social sciences. The fact that the case method gets you professionals and is seen over a long historical period of time to get you professionals, as it were, means that it is used by institution builders. I don't want to say entirely strategically, but it's used by them to help build disciplines. The reason that I say that I don't believe that there's just a purely strategic story to be told here about the use of a method which seems to generate institutional recognition. The reason I don't think that the story is that straightforward is precisely because this case method has these different aspects, right? That it's pedagogy, but it's also research practice. It's an epistemology. It's a sort of unstable but immensely productive method or conceptual scheme. And so, I don't think that there can be anything like a kind of, you know, it can't be used fully instrumentally, but it clearly is very important to the formation of the social sciences at Harvard during the 20th century. And so that's the kind of key role that this idea of the case method plays in the book.
Great. Now, after this this chapter that treats Henderson and the case method, and I'll just mention for listeners that one of the really helpful things here is that this chapter and the succeeding chapters put into practice the point that you're making about the relationship between epistemology and practice early in the book, and that is these chapters don't just state the case method was an important pedagogical tool, but really take us through the ways in which Henderson himself is using the sort of classic models and case books of Hippocrates in his own classes. So there's pedagogy comes in as a really important part of the argument and the content of the book on many, many different levels. And so it reinforces this larger point, I think, really nicely. So after this, there's another chapter that I'm not actually going to ask you too much about so that we can move to Quine and then ultimately get to Kuhn by the end of our time. But this is a chapter that I'll just again mention for listeners that gives a parallel case to the case of Henderson and the Pareto Circle that we just talked about, focusing on the discipline and rather disciplines, perhaps, of psychology at Harvard and the ways that operationism is developed by the physicist Percy Williams Bridgman in particular, but then you show the later development of this as a way also to relate scientific concepts to scientific practices. And so the idea of operationism here, and I'm being very rough and ready here, but this is the meaning of a concept is equivalent to the actions habitually associated with the concept. So again, we see another context of the interstitial academy being a place for the working out in a different kind of disciplinary field at Harvard of these relationships between ideas and practice and the centrality of practices in the way social scientists are thinking about human beings and knowledge making in that context. So this actually brings us to the chapter and the setting that you mention is perhaps the one piece that was retained from, I'm sure retained in a transformed version, but retained from the dissertation. And this is a close look at the discipline of philosophy at Harvard in this context, and in particular, a look at the way some Harvard philosophers, with Quine being kind of a focal point of this chapter, took what you call a self-referential turn in epistemology that maps onto and that tracks the kinds of turns that we saw in previous chapters with the Pareto Circle and with operationism. Now, it focuses on the way that Quine actually takes up, engages with, and ultimately critiques the work of Carnap in the Harvard complex. So can you say just a little bit about that? Can you talk about here how did Carnap's ideas become so central to Quine, and in what way is that central to the story that you're telling about the engagement of philosophers, and in particular the Harvard philosophers, in this larger trend that you're showing in the book?
Mm. Carnap Aquine was nothing less than a mentor, really. Perhaps Quine's only mentor. Quine, of course, is a towering figure in 20th century analytical philosophy. And Carnap, Rudolf Carnap, of course, was one of the leading lights of the Vienna circle of logical empiricists of the 1920s and 1930s. Carnap himself, I mean, just as a side note, emigrates to the United States in 1935 or 1936 and spends the rest of his career in the United States, having fled, as so many intellectuals did, the onset of fascism and Nazism in Central Europe in the 1930s. But Quine has a long and tangled history with Carnap, and many historians of logical empiricism, including not least your colleague Alan Richardson, have told some very important stories about the problems with Quine's reception of Carnap's work, the way in which he reads the driving ambitions and interests of Carnap's work. For Alan and for a number of other historians of logical empiricism, Quine misrepresents Carnap's project, and his turn towards Quine's turn towards philosophical naturalism is for many an unhappy displacement of the fundamental and driving interests of the Vienna Circle, and in particular of Carnap. The story I try and tell in the chapter really is one of discipleship, but then transformation. I mean, so in a way, I'm interested in trying to explain how it is that Quine comes to, as it were, misrepresent Carnap's philosophical program. And really what I want to say, and this is where the chapter on Quine rejoins the rest of the book, that it's Quine's being drawn into the interstitial academy, into these sort of marginal or interstitial kind of parts of the university, that really determines the character of his reception, and in particular his attempt to read Carnap as, in a sense, a kind of failed naturalist who doesn't appreciate how to be scientific about the conceptual foundations of the sciences, in a way that Quine has learned to be, thanks in part to his interaction with figures like B.F. Skinner and others in the interstitial academy at Harvard. And so there's a kind of key story. For Quine, I think Carnap's attempt to produce an account of what Carnap calls the logical syntax of the language of science, or what is in essence, an account of the logic of science, it provides Quine with a philosophical vocation. Quine comes to Harvard as a brilliant young logician trained at Oberlin. And Quine finds himself very much out of step with prevailing philosophical trends and interests at Harvard. He does have some very important teachers, not least Clarence Irving Lewis. But Quine is someone who's trained as a logician, who wants to find more to do with philosophical logic than the pure work, as it were, in philosophy of logic that's being conducted by people like Henry Scheffer at Harvard and others. Harvard's very strong in logic, but it's in the 1930s when Quine goes there to do his graduate work. But it's a very restricted conception of logic. Quine wants to get to philosophy, but he in fact doesn't really have much of a traditional philosophical education. And of course, he takes graduate courses and on a very compressed schedule. I mean, he's basically a graduate student for 18 months. I mean, this is
amazing.
It's one of the kind of downsides of being a scholar of extremely smart people, is you recognize how they're able to do all of these markers of an academic career that tend to be a struggle for oneself. But Quine takes 18 months to write a PhD and breeze through three or four courses in philosophy. But that's as much of a philosophical education that he gets. So he's basically, what I say, he's a clever logician who even post-PhD is looking for a way to become a philosopher, to speak to broader philosophical concerns and interests. Quine is elected to what is, for me, a preeminent example of the Interstitial Academy, and that's the Harvard Society of Fellows, which is founded in 1933. Quine is in the first generation of fellows, a cohort that includes the psychologist B.F. Skinner, in fact. And Quine, just before he joins the society, goes to Europe, studies with Rudolf Carnap in Prague, gives a paper to the Vienna Circle, which is just then on the brink of disintegrating, but is still meeting in Vienna, speaks to Alfred Tarski in Warsaw, the great Polish logician, and sees in Carnap's work and Carnap's work on the logical syntax of science a way of combining his skills in logic with broader questions, or to speak to broader questions in epistemology and even metaphysics. And so Quine goes back to the United States, goes into the Society of Fellows, and becomes an important conduit for the work of Carnap and the logical empiricists, and really becomes a kind of spokesman for Carnap. But what's interesting is he comes to see Carnap, not entirely incorrectly, but certainly not in a way that entirely captures the essence of Carnap's project. But he comes to see Carnap as someone interested in using the techniques of science the methods of science to understand the generation of scientific knowledge itself. So the kind of term that's used at the time quite often is the science of science. How can we have a science of science? And also Quine's idea is that what Carnap shows is that philosophy is the discipline that gives the science of science, that uses the findings of and the methods of the natural and mathematical sciences to give an account of the conceptual foundations of the sciences themselves. But Quine thinks that Carnap is not as engaged with currents in as many important currents in the sciences, particularly in psychology, as he needs to be. And so Quine gradually develops a kind of, or he uses Carnap really as a kind of stalking horse for his own project, which involves this more, apparently, at least according to Quine, a more thoroughgoing attempt to give an empirical scientific account of the generation of scientific knowledge. And what's striking about this enterprise is, I mean, firstly, you know, Kuhn is in close dialogue with Skinner, who's an old friend, B.F. Skinner, who's an old friend, is thanks to the Society of Fellows, Quine is drawn into various other forums of the Interstitial Academy and comes to see this attempt to create a science of science as a kind of collaborative enterprise. But Quine develops his philosophical naturalism within the confines of the Harvard complex, and not, as I argue in the book, in the Department of Philosophy, which remains in large part quite hostile to these new research programs emerging from Europe in these various forms of scientific philosophy. And so Quine, in order to pursue his interest in the work of Carnap and to develop this project, is almost forced to navigate his way through the Interstitial Academy. And then it's only, and I mean, this is just a kind of postscript, something I only touch on briefly in the book, but it's only in the 1950s, really, that the analytical revolution happens in philosophy, and what's previously a marginal approach becomes kind of dominant, and Quine becomes this kind of towering figure in analytical philosophy. But in any case, it seemed to me that, just to bring this rather long comment to a close, it seemed to me that one important way of making sense of the genesis of Quine's project is to see how he makes sense of and tries to build on Carnap's philosophy within the confines of the Interstitial Academy.
Great. Now, as we move to the last couple of chapters of the book, we move to the decades after World War II, and we see what happens in the rapid departmentalization of parts of the Interstitial Academy at Harvard in the next chapter. And I'll just sort of mention for listeners, this chapter called The Levelers focuses on a group of young non-tenured faculty in the mid-1930s who are really trying to collectively come up with a shared conceptual framework for a project of the behavioral sciences, right? And you're showing here, among other things, the ways that a Department of Social Relations emerges out of this context of the Interstitial Academy, the ways that some of the members of and people related to this Department of Social Relations and this group of faculty attempt to make theorizing seem like a legitimate professional activity on par with observable scientific practice, and ultimately how this project fails to crystallize. And so this is a really interesting case study that looks at the emergence of a kind of department of interstitial members and what happens as a result of that. Which brings us finally to Kuhn. So we started with Kuhn, now finally we're getting in chapter 6 to the chapter that looks at the career and work of Thomas Kuhn and really revises, I think, the way readers will think about this classic work of Kuhn, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. Now, among other things, this chapter I'll mention gives a really nice way to think about the history of the emergence of the history of science at Harvard and the sort of history of that department, which had its roots in one of Conant's, one of Kuhn's advisors or mentors, Conant. And you're showing here the emergence of a history of science and a pedagogy of the history of science at Harvard as part of this larger set of issues that you're looking at. Now, because I don't want to keep you for 2 hours, so because I definitely, though, do want to get to what for me was conceptually at the very heart of this book, I wonder if you could kind of wrap up this larger story by saying something about what seems to me to be one of the major contributions of this chapter and of the book, which is the demonstration of the importance of pedagogy to the way Kuhn was thinking about the history of science and the way that that shaped ultimately what happened in The Structure of Scientific Revolutions.
And I mean, that for me really is the kind of core of the book, and it's one reason why I wanted to conclude with Kuhn. The account that I try to give of Kuhn's development is, I mean, it really centers on an attempt to remind us that Kuhn began his career as someone deeply interested in pedagogical questions. And, you know, I mentioned, you know, at the beginning of our interview, I was very much inspired by the work of figures like, in particular, David Kaiser, Catherine Alesco, people who've written on pedagogy and practices of science. And I was sort of thrilled in a way to see that this, some of this approach and the emphasis upon pedagogy as a way into studying the history of epistemology, really, could promise insights for the study of Kuhn himself. And so what I do in the book really is show that from 1946 onwards, 1945, when Kuhn is asked to write a response on behalf of, as it were, or as a representative of Harvard's alumni, a response to the so-called Red Book, the Harvard Report on General Education in a Free Society. That famous book, Treatise of Liberal Pedagogy, produced in 1945, Kuhn is interested in, I mean, first of all, the question of how to teach science to laypersons, and in particular, I mean, in the Harvard context, how to teach science to those who won't be concentrating, to use the Harvard lingo, or majoring in the sciences themselves. And Kuhn recognized that, look, making undergraduates who aren't going to be concentrating in any kind of natural mathematical science, making them take kind of, you know, intro to you know, solid state physics or whatever is not going to be the way to teach them or to give them a feel for what Conan liked to call the tactics and strategies of science, right? So you need a way of teaching science to those who might need some grasp, because there'll be, you know, people holding the purse strings or politicians one day who'll have to engage scientists. But nonetheless, they can't themselves be trained as scientists. How do you do that? Kuhn's really is very much interested in this question, as is his mentor, Conant. And so Kuhn plays around a lot with this idea. The case method, thanks to Conant, becomes the way in which the history of the experimental sciences is taught. But this case method approach is designed explicitly for Conant to give non-scientists, these undergraduates who aren't concentrating in science, a sense for the tactics and strategies of science. Kuhn becomes interested in these ideas, plays around with the contrast between textbook and case method pedagogies, plays around with these ideas, while at the same time trying to develop an account of the social basis of scientific knowledge, really, which is a question that figures like Robert Merton, of course, are taking up at around about the same time. But Kuhn kind of wants to develop his own take. And just to, you know, I mean, not to talk for too long. So there's a kind of a narrative I give of Kuhn's intellectual evolution over the 1950s, in which I say, look, he starts by keeping these two wings of his work, this interest in pedagogy and general education in science, and then his interest in the historical and social foundations of scientific knowledge, kind of separate. And then what I suggest is, in his attempt to solve problems that he finds in drafting structure, I mean, he struggles for a long time. He first starts writing outlines for the book in the late 1940s, right? He doesn't publish it until 62. And he's playing around with ways of, like, how do you account for the progressive character of the sciences? Like, how are they able to formulate seemingly stable bodies of knowledge that persist for fairly long periods of time? And Kuhn for a long time says it's consensus. There's some kind of sociological underpinning to the possibility of scientific knowledge, and it's consensus. And it's consensus in particular on rules, how to conduct an inquiry, what counts as a successful solution of a problem, and so on. Then he recognizes that consensus on rules is not going to do that kind of work. And it's at that moment, which really happens very, very late in the drafting process of structure, maybe around 61, that I say he recognizes that the kind of case approach, which hitherto had been used only to teach the tactics and strategy of science to non-scientists, also explains very how scientists themselves learn how to solve problems and what counts as a legitimate solution to a problem, and therefore why their judgments can converge so well as they do in normal science, right? So my suggestion there is that although the natural assumption would be, and Kuhn inclines us to believe this, that it's Wittgenstein's ideas and the philosophical investigations that lead him to this concept of the paradigm. In fact, it's kind of ambient for him, thanks to the case of Harvard. So Kuhn ends up bringing together his kind of two sets of scholarly interests and coming up with the kind of theoretical structure of scientific revolutions.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me today. There's so much about the book that we didn't have a chance to get to, just a ton of stuff in all of the chapters. And certainly there are some chapters that we didn't have a chance to really talk about in too much depth in the first place. Is there anything in particular about the book that we didn't have a chance to talk about, but that you'd like to point out for listeners, and perhaps especially for listeners who haven't yet had a chance to read the book?
Sure. You know, you've covered most of the bases, really. Something perhaps I would just want to underscore is I have a line in the prologue, which I follow up in the epilogue, in the kind of concluding part of the book, which is, I hope, in addition to giving what I hope is a sort of interesting history, that the book can contribute to an erosion of what I think is of as a very unhelpful way of thinking about the possibilities for the development of the human sciences in our own contemporary moment, which is this kind of sharp division between positivist or formalist approaches and interpretivist or hermeneutic approaches to the study of human behavior. Scientific versus humanist, you know, to put that in a very sort of broad way. And it seems to me that so much of contemporary discussion is about the human sciences as a field of possibilities for inquiry, is shaped by these binaries. And it seems to me unhelpful strategically to think in that way. But also what I hope to show in the book is that if we look at what seems to be the exact moment where there is, you know, a revolt against positivism, there's a positivist culture in the social sciences and it's overthrown by Kuhn, essentially. The history is much more complex, and the continuities are such that the story about positivism succeeded by post-positivism isn't a helpful one. It's not one that practicing social scientists ought to tell themselves. And I realize that as an historian, as it were, I mean, I can't force a kind of a normative point, and I wouldn't want to. But it seems to me that at least in this one case, attending more closely to the recent history of debates about the scientific or just general epistemic character of knowledge in the social sciences can remove certain limitations on our imaginations of what kinds of knowledge-making practices are possible in those fields. So I'd like to think that at the very least, the book might help to kind of stimulate a more open-ended debate about that topic.
Great. And now that the book is out, and congratulations, it's a fantastic book, as I'm sure came out in the course of our discussion, and I'll just say it explicitly if I haven't made that absolutely clear already. Now that this fantastic book is out, what's next for you? What project or projects are currently inspiring you at the moment?
Sure. Well, I've been moving in something of a different direction from the project I pursued in Working Knowledge. And so I am interested in actually the American Constitution in the era between the New Deal and the Cold War. And in particular, I'm interested in rewriting or rethinking the history of American political thought in this period through the lens of emergency politics. And all I'd say there, and I won't talk about this for too long, is that a good deal of the legislation of Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal, economic legislation and so forth, as well as various statutes and policies established during World War II were passed under presidential war powers. These were emergency measures that became permanent features of American politics. And I'm struck by how the politics of emergency became central to the practice of American politics in the 20th century, at the same time that the rhetoric and practices of liberal politics and indeed also human rights are becoming increasingly central. And that seems in a sense like a sort of paradox, that on the one hand you have the development of a kind of democratic form of dictatorship, and on the other the rise of liberalism of a certain kind, of a kind of welfare state kind after World War II. And I want to try and explain that. And so I hope the next project will focus on that. And it will really be a study in American political thought, so somewhat different from Working Knowledge.
Well, thank you again so much for making the time. It's really been a pleasure, and good luck with the next project.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to New Books in Science, Technology, and Society. Thanks very much for joining us, and we'll see you next time.